It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction released the annual report cards this week for schools across the state.
About 84% of Wisconsin's public schools met or exceeded state expectations for the last school year, up slightly from the year before.
This year, though, DPI changed the thresholds for how students scored on state standardized tests, making comparisons a little more difficult than usual.
We're checking in on what we can learn from this year's state report card and how parents and community members can make sense of their local scores.
Sarah Shaw is the Deputy Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, where she focuses on education. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, people are familiar with the report cards they take home from school at the end of a school year. These are a little different. What goes into these Department of Public Instruction report cards for schools and districts?
So these district report cards and school report cards are meant to inform parents, community members, schools themselves, and policymakers about how schools are doing and how districts are doing. And they take into account standardized test scores, including both how kids achieve, but also how they've grown compared to other kids like them. And they also bring in factors like attendance or chronic absenteeism and graduation data as well.
A few different criteria, a lot of schools in Wisconsin, a flood of data here. Sarah, what stands out to you big picture in this year's report cards?
Well, this year's report cards, as you mentioned, tell us some things and perhaps are more telling for what they don't tell. So we can see, you mentioned that 84% of public schools met or exceeded expectations. 85% of the private schools that receive report cards, which is not all private schools, also met or exceeded expectations. Of those districts, we had just the public school districts, close to 60% of them meeting expectations, which is kind of the middle ground. So that tells us what they received this year. But the trouble is we want to use the report cards to see how things have changed. Is it a district going in the right direction? Is it struggling more? And because of changes in the scoring, we can't compare these report cards to previous years in a way that allows us to really see what direction a district or a school is going.
Yeah, talk a little more about those test score threshold changes. And those thresholds, I understand, changed because the tests changed in what they're measuring in some ways. What went into that decision, a big decision to change the tests and the way we evaluate them?
Yeah, so DPI had updated academic standards and then aligned, in this case specifically, the state test for third to eighth graders to reflect those updated standards, and then changed the scores and the performance levels, whether we consider a student to be meeting expectations or exceeding or below, based on those new cut scores. The ACT, which is the test for the high schoolers, didn't change, but those cut scores or performance levels did. So that's what's disrupting the comparability with other years. DPI will say that this test is now better aligned to what we actually expect students to be able to do and the skills that they should show. And while others are concerned that this constitutes a lowering of standards or that they could have made this change, but also still provided a crosswalk to previous years so that we could understand how this year's scores compare with previous years.
On a policy level, what are these tests for? What are education officials, legislators, others taking this test and doing with it, if anything?
So theoretically, these tests can be a great way of giving a snapshot of student learning in a way that can tell parents where their student is at in a standardized way, in a way that allows them to compare to other students and other schools. Can also be a helpful tool for teachers and school leaders and district leaders trying to gauge how well they are doing and where they could modify instruction to reach students better. And it helps policymakers get a sense of how is the state doing? How is a locality doing? Are we setting the conditions such that students can succeed? That's in theory. When it comes to practice, sometimes we have the questions about, are these tests coming out and do the report cards come out in a timely enough manner to be able to properly inform change? Do parents know how to use these report cards in a way that really helps them advocate for their child or ask good questions? And when we get a change like this in what is getting measured and how, that can disrupt those conversations.
And you just hit on something I really wanted to highlight. For a parent listening, they're nodding along, okay, statewide numbers, whatever. I think they're mostly going to be interested in my kid's school, What did it do? Oh, and up 2 points here and down 2 points there. What would you recommend for a parent looking at their local school and their local district score and how to read these tests and make sense of what they're seeing?
Yeah, so I would probably start by throwing out the idea that we can compare this year's to last year's. You know, going up by 2 points doesn't, we don't know what that means right now, because we know that the DPI changes did lead to higher proficiency levels across the board. So a parent looking at their school and saying, oh, we're more proficient now, isn't equipped to know, and none of us are equipped to know, whether that's because things actually got better or because we just changed how we were measuring things. So I really recommend starting that conversation with bringing it back to my student. And can you tell me what are they doing that's right on grade level, exactly what you expect? Where do you see them shining? Where do you see them struggling? And having that conversation from a growth mindset around every child is bringing a lot of assets into the classroom. And we should hope that every child still has room to grow. And a teacher who's paying attention and a school that's paying attention to learning will be able to answer those questions and support your student to their greatest success. And if they're not equipped, your asking the question is going to help prompt them to think of that.
Talking to Sarah Shaw from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, making sense of the new round of report cards for not students, but for schools and districts around the state. The DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, just put out the latest report cards this week. Sarah, here at Wisconsin Today, we were poking around at some school districts around the state. We didn't do a comprehensive data crunch, but it stood out to us that at least some districts, more middle schools seem to be not hitting those benchmarks, not hitting the, you know, the satisfactory level. Is that a trend you see around the state, or did we just happen to stumble across districts that had middle schools that were having trouble?
It's a good question, and not one that we've looked into specifically, but one piece I'll throw out there is that we have been tracking chronic absenteeism pretty closely. So this is a measure that's included in the state report card. It goes into these scores, and it skyrocketed after the pandemic. And middle schoolers, in addition to our elementary schoolers, have been some of the ones that have seen their recovery be slowest. So our high school students typically are absent from school on a chronic basis, meaning they're missing more than 10% of school days in the school year, or usually 18 or more days. So our high schoolers typically have the highest chronic absenteeism rates, but the elementary schoolers and middle schoolers, while they didn't go up as high as high school, also haven't come back down by as much. So I'm curious as to whether we're going to see that as a big factor in how well schools can serve children if children are not there in school.
And you brought up the pandemic, and that's been a big open question. How much did the pandemic impact student performance, school performance after a long stretch of remote learning? Looking over the last few years, Sarah, what do you have your eye on, both in these report cards and in other education data you've been watching to see how kids are doing post the worst days of the pandemic?
Yeah, so that chronic absenteeism data is a big one just because it was so disruptive. We have districts where over 50% of students are not in school, or over 40% of school students are not in school on a regular basis. So that's a big one for us. Mental health outcomes, which we don't have on a district by district level, but we do have state data showing that even before the pandemic, youth mental health was worsening. And so seeing how both at the school level and societally, we can be supporting that. And then academically, and part of our concern here is whether these report cards and the tests behind them are going to give us a consistent source of data to be able to see what was happening pre-pandemic and what is happening now, to understand whether we really are recovering or whether we've just changed the test and now we can't tell.
Well, it seems like we don't need the report card to tell us absenteeism is a problem. What are you seeing schools do and districts do to try to get kids back into the school building? In the old days, they had the truant officers wandering around town. I don't know if that's a thing anymore. But what kind of outreach is there to try to get kids at the desks?
Right now, it's been a typically more supportive approach than punitive from school districts, really working to reach out to families and find out why are students missing school. And we hear a whole host of reasons, things like housing instability or rising childcare costs, where an older student might be looking after a younger sibling. Things like mental health come into play if that's going to cause a student to want to avoid school. and potentially have a parent who feels really sympathetic to that concern. There's also cases where transportation has been spotty. We've had a bus driver shortage the last couple of years, which has impacted that. And then I think there's also messaging from the pandemic that we're still shaking off. So the message of you don't go to school if you're sick. Well, that's certainly true if you have COVID-19, but there's a whole range of other illnesses where it's more of a gray area. COVID also taught us that we may not need to be in school. And we have learned that being in school, not for all students, but for many students, really is the best way to have access to learning. So undoing some of that messaging from the pandemic has been a challenge and something that schools can use a really comprehensive, coherent communication strategy, something intentional to tell parents, hey, things have changed. Tell community members, this is now, we're going back to where we believe that school is an important place for your child to be. And if you're not here, you are missed and you're at risk of falling behind.
And you mentioned this report card, of course, doesn't answer everything. In our last half a minute or so, what is the biggest open question for you about how we evaluate student performance in our schools?
I think if we consider specifically the pandemic, Wisconsin pre-pandemic had some of the widest achievement gaps in the country. And so as we recover from the pandemic, I think it's really important for us to be focusing not just on how the state as a whole or on average is recovering, but specifically for our students who are most vulnerable pre-pandemic. Are we letting them fall further behind, or are we putting really intentional supports in there and looking at them carefully to make sure we're supporting them in the best way possible?
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Shaw, Deputy Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She was with us today to review the annual Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction school report cards that were released this week. Want to hear from you. Let's pick one particular point. Absenteeism. Has your kid had trouble making it to school? What is the problem? What kind of things, what kind of obstacles are there? What could help you solve that? If you're a teacher, what are you seeing in your classrooms? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, the most important tools for these police officers are their ears.
The biggest skill set that we utilize in a negotiation is our active listening skills.
Go behind the scenes with crisis negotiators in Wisconsin police departments coming up on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Most of us will have difficult conversations at some point in our lives, but few of us are faced with negotiations that are literally matters of life and death.
Police crisis negotiators are called in to resolve situations where hostages are taken, someone is threatening suicide, or there is an armed standoff. Crisis negotiators are trained to deal with people who are facing their worst moments and feel like they've run out of options.
These standoffs aren't everyday occurrences, but they happen often enough that a group was formed in 1998 to train Wisconsin law enforcement. Two of the board members of the Wisconsin Crisis Negotiators Association join us now for a look at their jobs and lessons in listening that we can apply in our everyday lives. Detective Bradley Tatro is the crisis negotiation team leader for the Marathon County Sheriff's Office, and Lieutenant Trevor Bilgo works for the Brown County Sheriff's Office. Lieutenant Bilgo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Detective Tatro, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Detective Tatro, let's start with you. Are you seeing more calls for crisis negotiators in police work, both in your own precinct and around the state?
So in my general location, we have about 176,000 for a population, and we have not seen an increase over the last, I'd say, 3 years. But it does, like every other year, kind of come in spurts.
And Lieutenant Bilgo, can you spell out the basics for us? What is involved? What kind of calls might you get for crisis negotiation?
Sure. When a crisis negotiator team or negotiators called out requested, it's usually calls that are above a basic patrolman's level based on their expertise. And it could be anything from a suicidal individual, person in a mental health crisis, suicidal barricade, or an armed situation, all the way up to assisting the SWAT and tactical units on a tactical call out.
Obviously a very difficult situation, Detective Tatro. Can you talk about some of the key tactics, maybe even skills we could call them, that you use when you're called to help resolve a crisis like this?
Sure. The biggest skill set that we utilize in a negotiation is our active listening skills. Those are things from open-ended questions, emotional labeling, paraphrasing, effective pauses, minimal encouragers, I messages, summarizing and mirroring. We use those techniques along with time to kind of de-escalate a situation.
Lieutenant Bilgo, I might think, okay, either you've got this kind of skill or you don't. Can we train people on this? Is there effective training that helps people develop these skills?
Yeah, everybody can be trained in it, but just like any skill, sometimes you just have a natural act for it. And it, like any skill, if you don't train it and practice with it, you can lose it. So this is a skill that crisis negotiators do need to keep up on, or in the time you're called upon, you may not be as proficient or as effective as you could be.
And Detective Tatro, how do you train in active listening?
So for my team, we train 10 times a year. So 10 months out of the year, we're having our own training. We do scenario-based training. We train with our SWAT team. We set up fairly elaborate scenarios with role players so that we are getting, you know, kind of a live goal and a live use of our skills. And then, you know, something that you can use every day in conversations with people where you can use those skills and just keep them fresh.
Lieutenant Bilgo, you mentioned, you know, this the specialized training here might be when that line police officer, it's something a little beyond their normal duties. That said, is this kind of training becoming more standard for police officers, whatever job they're doing?
I do believe so. There is the crisis intervention training that your baseline police officers are, I think, pretty across the board getting trained in. And that is for that baseline officer to be able to deal with some of the mental health crises and individuals that they may be seeing out on the road. There is an uptick even with our local dispatch center that the dispatchers have requested training or some advanced training, since they are the ones that take those initial calls for us, on some effective crisis negotiator skills to assist them as well.
Detective Tatro, a word that gets thrown around a lot these days with policing is the idea of de-escalation, which sounds great in theory, fantastic. I imagine in practice with, you know, a very emotional situation for whoever you're dealing with, it might be easier said than done. What can de-escalation look like in a difficult situation?
Sure. So de-escalation definitely is a buzzword that is thrown around a lot lately. It is a great tool. It's a great objective. We have to realize also that there are situations where de-escalation is not appropriate, when there's exclusion and we've exhausted all other options. But what it looks like when we are having that de-escalation, it's a good communication narrative with the person that we're our subject. We're taking time. We are doing our best to try and understand their point of view from whatever issue is arising. We see it a lot with you know, politics. Let's touch on that very, very shortly. Everyone has their own idea on their political stance, and it's easy to get into an argument with somebody over politics. But if you take the time and you use active listening skills and empathy, you can try and understand where they're coming from. So in a situation where things are elevated, if you're doing your best to get an understanding of their point of view, that's going to help you build that rapport with that person, eventually influence them, and then have a change in behavior where hopefully everything ends peacefully.
Lieutenant Bilgo, what I think I'm hearing from both of you is, you know, we can have some general rules and principles in place, but in practice, there's no one size fits all. How much do you have to tailor your active listening, your interaction based on each specific situation?
It's a constant change of venue for us. That's why we train our teams. I think most teams do that. You don't have just one or two primary negotiators because maybe a certain person on your team is a better fit for that individual, or maybe they just don't like the tone of your voice at that time and wants to hear somebody else. So it's very flexible. It's constantly changing. And we need to be able to adapt. And the biggest thing is we need to just sometimes stop talking and listen, as Detective said. And once we get to that point, we can usually achieve our goal. It just takes time.
Detective Tatro, I can imagine you don't get to pick your schedule for when this happens, right? Are you, in effect, on call, 24/7 some weeks if that situation happens and they need somebody now?
Yeah, so our team is comprised of 11 members, and you could say that we're all on call 24/7. It doesn't mean that every member has to respond at every call out, but we like to have, you know, six or seven, if we can, respond to each call out. So we have that ability to cover all the responsibilities and that ability to change negotiator if needed.
Lieutenant Bilgo, you are both part of this statewide organization, the Wisconsin Crisis Negotiators Association. Like, how much knowledge sharing, how much idea sharing do you do with your colleagues around the state?
I always say every conference we go to is an opportunity for networking, and networking at the negotiator level, it really is priceless. Even if we only get together a couple times a year, there's a lot of information we can pick up from each other, from tactics to what might have worked, what didn't, from correctional settings to, in a big city or a rural area. Everything changes for us in law enforcement constantly. And to be able to have a statewide network that we're able to tap into as either leaders of the team or as members of a team through an association to share that information, it really is priceless in our line of work.
We are talking about police crisis negotiation with two people who actually do that job, Lieutenant Trevor Bilgo with the Brown County Sheriff's Office, Detective Bradley Tatro, Marathon County Sheriff's Office, both on the board of the Wisconsin Crisis Negotiators Association. Okay, now you both do a job that gets portrayed in pop culture, TV shows, movies, and maybe people even think they understand your job based on what they see in pop culture. I want to ask each of you, what you see in TV movies that gets it right or gets it wrong. Detective Tatro, let's start with you.
Off the top of my head, I can think of the movie The Other Guys, and they're negotiating. And obviously that is a comedy,
right,
and meant to not portray it properly. But it's about as bad as it could get as a negotiator in that standpoint. So I think with the trend towards de-escalation in policing, some of the shows are looking at negotiation in a better light and more accurately. However, it's not made for TV stuff. This takes a long time. It cannot be very exciting when you're talking for a long time and listening for a long time. So it's not really made for Hollywood type stuff.
I'm glad to hear that The Other Guys is not an accurate portrayal of policing. That reassures me a lot, I think. Lieutenant Bilgo, how about you? Any pop culture examples that pop to your mind, for better or worse?
Well, the classic movie, The Negotiator, and mm-hmm. we always joke, we ask new applicants, have they watched that movie? And there is a lot in there. Sometimes you do have some conflicts, sometimes between the TAC teams or your TAC command and negotiators. Negotiators want to talk and they want to take time. And sometimes the TAC guys want to move and get things done. But over the years, as Detective said, too, we both work with our individual SWAT teams, our TAC guys. So we all have a mutual understanding of what our each other's roles are. Sometimes they really portray that in the movies, a complete separation. And that's not the reality of it. But you have to train and, again, get that team understanding to move forward with it.
All right, getting back to real-world policing. Detective Tatro, younger officers, do they show an interest in getting this kind of training, even if they're not going to be that specialized negotiator?
So our agency does a good job in training de-escalation, even at the range when we're there for training. So our younger officers are getting that training. We had a few that have shown interest in actually being part of the team and getting some more advanced training, which is fantastic. And there's opportunities out there for them to do that. Our team is also comprised of dispatchers and corrections officers. So it's not just for us sworn police officers that are going to get this training and put it to use. Mm-hmm. So there is that interest, and we are, you know, fostering that.
And Lieutenant Bilgo, Detective Tatro earlier mentioned that, you know, at some point you have to make a read on when negotiation isn't the answer. This isn't what you need to do now. How do you draw that line? How do you say, okay, this is not a negotiation situation, or at least, or maybe not anymore?
That comes usually on our end. That'll come through as a team leader on my role, my shoulders, responsibility, along with the SWAT commander. And that just comes through training and trust and constant assessment throughout the course of the negotiation or the call out that we may be on. And it's that tight network of trust and building that relationship between the two leaders and realizing at this point we may have to assist or get the person in a better position for a tactical operation or a movement. And that is hard for the negotiators to deal with if it truly does go that direction, because they have worked so hard for it. But there is a point in a reality that we do know that it could be a tactical resolution instead.
Detective Tatro, if I can get a little personal here, I mean, this is obviously a very stressful job, or it seems like it would be to me. What do you and other negotiators do to take care of yourselves? You know, if something has not got, you haven't gotten the outcome you want to, how do you get past that and be ready for the next call?
So a very important part of our, not only our negotiation team, but our other special teams as well, is to debrief an incident so that when the incident is concluded and everything is wrapped up investigative wise, you get together, you sit down, you go over the incident, the goods, the bads, what we could do better next time. And then, you know, we have peer support in our agency. So if you are still feeling that you need some help with something, you can reach out to a peer support member, talk with them. They can help you guide through any other services that you might need.
Lieutenant Bilgo, along the same lines, do you feel like there's enough of this kind of support out there in your own sheriff's department and around the state?
I think as a state, we can be doing better. There are some agencies that are a little behind, and we need to be able to help them out as well. But within my own agency, very similar to detectives there, we have the same setup that we will debrief, that we do have mental health counselors, professionals available to us, that if we need to take it to a further level for our officers, we are definitely going to do that to support them to get through it, because it can be a very emotional roller coaster if it is an extended period of time as that primary negotiator.
Now, everybody's going to have, you know, difficult conversations in their lives, hopefully not as difficult as the ones we're talking about. Detective Tatro, though, are there skills, concepts you've learned as part of this job that you learn in your daily life that you think other people could use for difficult negotiations, difficult conversations?
Yeah, so I think one of the most powerful things that we learned as negotiators is emotional labeling. And it's something that you can use, I mean, constantly throughout your daily life. If I'm talking with one of my children or my spouse, they're upset. It's an, you know, not necessarily a crisis situation, but they're elevated. And I can throw the emotional label out there that, you know, you sound like you're pretty stressed out, and that'll get them talking. And then I can listen to what they're saying as to why they're feeling that way. Or if they're not feeling stressed out, they're going to tell me what emotion actually is. You know, they're not going to be upset that I labeled it incorrectly, but it's going to give us a talking point. So anytime there's that kind of conflict, you know, that's one of our skills that I find very useful.
And that's interesting, Lieutenant Bilgo. And again, I can imagine this in daily life. People might take it as a sign of respect or appreciate that you're having a go at understanding what's going on with them. Is that a difference maker, do you think?
100%. And they'll, like you said, they'll call you out if you labeled it wrong. But the point is, if they're talking to us and we're listening and that conversation is happening between us as negotiators and our individual we're working with, they're not doing something else to either harm themselves or someone else. And as long as we can continue that, whatever little hook we use to get them to give us feedback, that's a positive in our world.
I'm super interested in my job and the idea of active listening, always trying to get better at it myself. Detective Tatro, are there skills, are there techniques, I guess you'd say, that we can use to learn to be better active listeners?
There's kind of eight skills that are out there that are the kind of foundation of active listening. I spoke about them earlier. It's the open-ended questions. It's really, the focus is to listen to understand and not listening to respond. Most of us try and listen to respond. We have a response that we've already come up with in our mind that we want to get out, and we're just waiting for that break in that conversation so you can get your piece out. Instead of just waiting, listening to what they have to say, and then giving yourself some time to formulate a response after they're done.
Lieutenant Bilgo, do you have advice to add on making us better active listeners, again, regardless of our line of work?
He stole it right from me. That's he took it first, and that's great. But that's exactly what I was going to say was, in our world and just dealing with people and just in general, I think we all could just take a little more time to listen before we're all so quick to say something before we probably should.
We'll leave it there. Lieutenant Bilgo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
And Detective Tatro, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was greatly appreciated.
Detective Bradley Tatro is the Crisis Negotiation Team Leader for the Marathon County Sheriff's Office. Lieutenant Trevor Bilgo is with the Brown County Sheriff's Office. They're both on the board of the Wisconsin Crisis Negotiators Association.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Madison perfume maker who made a signature scent for our state says smell is key to our human experience.
It's really connected to your memory brain. It's connected to your emotion brain. You can utilize it as a superpower.
Aromas of Wisconsin, that conversation coming up from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, Miller High Life served up a limited edition cologne.
The Milwaukee-based beer company made a cologne that takes all the flavors and aromas of a local dive bar and bottles it up in a spritz.
It's appropriately named Dive Barfume, combining notes of cedarwood and patchouli to evoke a bar counter. A chapaca blossom is added to mimic the Miller Life beer.
To learn about perfume making in Wisconsin, we turn to Christy Moe, founder and president of Zotica Perfumery in Madison. Christy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It is amazing to be here after listening to you for so long.
Thank you. What are your thoughts, first, on the release of Miller's Dive Barfume?
I think that's an appropriate reaction. Laughter. I love it. It's so novel. It's fun. You know, perfume and cologne in general, like, it purely exists for our pleasure and for our entertainment. Why not have fun with it? They clearly know their customer. They know their likes and their dislikes. And this is something that I think for the ultimate fan, they will eat it up.
I hope not. But does the scent, though, does its creation prove that while maybe one scent might be off-putting to one person, another person might think it's really wonderful?
This is true. I mean, scent is such a personal experience because it plays directly to your emotions and to your memories. So I feel like for their customer base who has some amazing memories in those type of settings, right? For them, it's going to be something that symbolizes an important part of their life and something that they want to express about themselves.
And the cologne really sets a scene. I mean, it draws on both smells and tastes that you would find in a bar. Sea salt, for instance, is supposed to resemble the basket of fries at the end of the night. Is it possible to capture all of these types of attributes in a spritz?
I think yes, because at the core, scent is very directly connected to our emotion brain and our memory brain. So if you think about aromatherapy and the properties behind that, there's literal scent notes that can evoke a feeling of calm or peace or excitement, alertness, focus. And so I think for the right nose or perfumer, when they are coming up with that formulation, yes, I think that they can execute something that really triggers like a memory or nostalgia.
And for an industry insider, this is described as a unisex scent. Is it difficult to create scents that are made to be worn by all people?
Unisex is kind of a controversial area because I think that generally when we say unisex, I think the average person would recognize that as being maybe more generally clean scents that have a lot of citrus notes in it that could appeal very easily to everyone.
I understand you haven't had a chance to sample Dive Barfum yet, but when you look at what's behind this Barfum, is it bold or a traditional choice? What is your instinct?
I would assume that it would be more traditional from the scent notes that I was reading. You know, I think that at the end of the day, it's a product. They want to be able to sell the product. And so they are trying to sell a product to the masses. So it can't be too off the map as far as like pushing boundaries. So I think it's probably going to be more of a traditional scent that a lot of people are going to like.
We are talking about the perfume industry in Wisconsin with recent news that Miller Brewing Company has made a cologne called Dive Barfum. And our guest is Christy Moe, founder of a perfumery in Madison. Christy, let's turn to your scent called Eau de Wisconsin that you created in 2020. How do perfume makers go about capturing the scent of a place or even an idea?
Well, I can speak to me personally. So for me personally, I tried to capture the scent of Wisconsin through a very metaphysical, esoteric process that involved looking at the birth date, essentially, of Wisconsin when it was founded, and using that birth date and then taking that into a sky map and seeing where all the planets were at the day that Wisconsin was founded as a state and accepted into the Union, and then using that as an inspiration point. So then seeing what were the most important aspects of that unique point in time, and then using our zodiac fragrances to create a layered perfume that had some substance and meaning to it that was very specific to Wisconsin's history. For other perfumers that are trying to create a scent based on a location, they can be inspired potentially by whatever is in that environment. So for Dive Barfum, I believe that they had looked at the countertops, for example, as a point of inspiration.
And bar stools.
Yeah. So for another location, they might be looking at what are the plants and fruits that are in season during a point of time that most people travel there and enjoy there and create memories during that time of year and creating a scent based on that time frame. So it depends on whatever they're most inspired by.
Well, without further ado, what went into Wisconsin scent? Can you describe it for us?
Yes. I mean, I had a customer actually that explained her experience with Eau de Wisconsin. It was like blue sky that was just hugging you. So I wasn't trying to make Wisconsin smell like a particular scent, actually. And I promise you, it doesn't smell like cheese or beer.
Or Packers, I don't know.
Or brats. But it does kind of
give you this nostalgic feeling of what Wisconsin is, because it has this green kind of aspect to it and some citrus notes that are reminiscent of when we love Wisconsin the most, which is usually around that June timeframe. Mm. So it's capturing that beautiful time of year. It's capturing the woodiness of walking through a forest. And it's just kind of intoxicating. But yeah, it's meant to kind of feel like home, actually.
Aww.
And it does for a lot of people.
You've been around scents for so long. What is your most interesting scent profile that you've ever come across in your work?
That's a good question. Interesting scent profile. You know, trying to capture for me, like, the most interesting scent profiles is certain things that happen in nature, like petrichor, like the different scent of, like, when it rains. Like, being able, we love that smell, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And being able to capture that in a scent profile so that we can recreate it and enjoy it and have it in a bottle sitting on our dresser and be able to smell that at any time. Mm-hmm. I'm really big on aromatherapy and creating scent profiles that are triggering emotions in a very positive way, whether that's, you know, making us feel happy or relaxed or excited or, you know, sensual for our partner. All of those good emotions is what I really get excited about. And I, because that's the most impact that I can have personally in my line of work. And I feel like what I am here on this earth to create, you know, positive change with. Mm-hmm. And creating memories from those emotions. So the fact that you can smell, you can spray a scent on your skin and improve your day, like, that's fascinating to me.
Hmm. In your line of work, Wisconsin and the Midwest may not be known as a perfume capital or
sure.
among perfume makers. Are there makers in our state, though, or region whose work you're excited about?
I mean, it's very hard to make a good perfume. So there's not a lot of indie perfumers out there. And when you do come across a perfumer, there is a concentration of perfumers that are, say, like on the East Coast or even on the West Coast. And the reason why is because the oil manufacturers are there. So it's easier to be close to those resources. So it is very rare to find perfumers outside of those locations.
I'm wondering, since you have a manufacturing facility in Madison, do you ever come across shortage issues of a particular ingredient, and how do you get through those logistical issues?
Yes, it happens more often than people, I think, realize. And for us, we've been very fortunate with planning. I think trying to do any type of projection is really just taking a dart and throwing it at a board and trying to hit a target. So it's really difficult for planning of what you're going to need. And since 2020 and with COVID happening, I learned a very important lesson with that, and making sure that I have a good supply chain and have partners that I can lean on and utilize and have backup options if I need to go to that. But we got stuck a little bit in 2020 with shortages on things, but there's certain things that you just can't predict. Like, if there's a drought somewhere, that's obviously going to impact a certain type of ingredient. Or if there's a flood, like, there's certain things that just are going to impact perfumery in a way that maybe people don't necessarily realize. But I try to plan out in advance about a year.
Hmm.
Yeah.
If someone comes to you and says, "Christy, I don't do scents. I don't like to have scents on anything," can you persuade them?
Absolutely, because I was that person. I was a person that wanted to avoid scent at all costs because I'm so sensitive to it, and it would trigger headaches most of the time. I can't do candles most of the time. If I am in a relationship with someone, I'm choosing their shampoo and their conditioner and their soap. And anything that triggers a headache for me goes into the trash can, unfortunately. But I am that person that was very sensitive, and
But the thing is that scent is such part of our human experience. Like, the more you learn about that and how impactful and positive it can be to your daily life, and how it's really connected to your memory brain, it's connected to your emotion brain, you can utilize it as a superpower. So when you are able to have a repertoire of scent that doesn't trigger for you, that you can actually enjoy, it's life-changing, because you can suddenly be applying the scent on your body and conjure up these memories from, you know, decades ago, memories of loved ones that may no longer be with us, right?
Like a mom.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Or capturing a memory for future recall, capturing your wedding day, for example, capturing, you know, the time that you found out that you were pregnant, or the birth of your child. So utilizing scent as a superpower and as you know, part of your human experience is very important.
How about we try some scents?
Yes.
Yeah. So what should we do first here?
Well, should we review Sagittarius?
Let's go for Sagittarius.
Sag season right now.
And so here on the display, you have all of the zodiac symbols in kind of going around all the constellations. All right, let me take a smell here. Now, I do smell the fruitiness coming through. Strawberry, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Good nose.
Yes. So the fruit hits me at first, and then the scent might start to settle.
Yes. So in perfumery, there's something called top, middle, and bottom notes. Mm-hmm. What you're smelling initially are those top notes. They're top notes because they're the most volatile. They're the lightest weight oils. So they literally will evaporate faster. Mm-hmm. And so they hit your nose first. And then as it dries down, you'll experience the other notes that are in the formula.
Cinnamon, and then the vanilla, and those coming in a little bit later in the fragrance. Oh. And so as you go through the course of your day, you might find that it changes as the day wears on.
Yes, absolutely. So our perfumes have anywhere from 50 to 100 oils, and that's pretty standard for most perfume formulations, unless you're doing like a very simple essential oil blend. So the idea here is, with a fine fragrance, you do want it to change over time, because that is showing that the way it was constructed has all these oils in it, and it's giving you that experience throughout the day. And then also, like, as you apply that perfume or cologne on your skin, it's going to interact with your own chemistry and really personalize it.
And so for Sagittarius, what characteristics, went into this formulation?
It's interesting, because it's not what I think a Sagittarius should smell like or should like. It's all based on 3 years of blind scent studies that I did with women all across the U.S. And what I found is that there's patterns that were happening. So Sagittarius women were consistently choosing the same or similar scent notes over other ones. And what they liked was different than, say, like what a Leo or what a Virgo would like. So I literally based the formula on the Sagittarius women's scent preferences.
Huh. You crowdsourced it.
I crowdsourced it. Exactly. Exactly.
Christy, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me be here today.
Christy Moe is founder and president of Zotica Perfumery, and she talked with us about Miller High Life's new Barfume Cologne and the business of perfume making in Wisconsin.
Back on 2024 and inviting you to share some of your favorite memories from the year over the course of this week. And today we're looking for your favorite food experiences of the year.
Did you discover a great new restaurant in your community, or did you try something new at an old favorite?
Maybe it's something from your home cooking. Do you have a new favorite dish to make for friends and family, or did somebody else cook a memorable meal for you?
And sometimes it's not just the food, but it's the people you share it with. Was there a special get-together over a meal that served up great memories?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text 888-642-0100. 1-800-273-0232 to share your best food memories of 2024.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.